Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, I think that the key critical issue in this case is whether Missouri should extend defense of implied primary assumption of risk, otherwise known as the no-duty rule, to the activities and the antics of a team mascot who is down on the stadium throwing hot dogs directly into the face of the Royals' business invitees.
Now, Royals doing very well this year. This is good.
My firm is a season ticket holder, and I go to many games.
And your client goes to the game. It was testimony goes 175 games. He said, "Isn't this conceivably? Doesn't he know the guy's throwing hot dogs? And isn't this a foreseeable risk that he would understand that you could be hit by a hot dog?"
Your Honor, the testimony was that Slugger himself knew he should make eye contact with the intended recipient. He testified that he'd been taught that by the Royals, and that he knew he should make eye contact. He should toss that hot dog gently, and he testified that he was well aware that if he winged a hot dog at somebody, he could seriously injure that person.
Now, what about, I have to admit, I've been a malefactor also, where a friend of mine had a ticket that was 20 rows up, and then he moved down when no one else was there to the better seats when no one was there.
Well, Your Honor, I've heard the Royals say that on numerous occasions. They said that in their brief, and they've said it in the brief here, but the evidence that's in the record is that Mr. Coomer had a ticket 6 rows back on the first base side. But he happened to be a Tigers fan, and the Tigers were playing that day, so he took his ticket and went to 6 rows behind the third base.
Right.
And so he was in the same section. He had an expensive ticket to be way down front, and instead of 6 rows behind the first base, he went 6 rows behind the third base.
Eminent logic to that.
So he could see the Tigers. The Royals were his second favorite team. The Tigers were his first. No case in the United States, let alone Missouri, has ever extended the no-duty rule to the activities of a team mascot.
Why is it logical to apply the assumption of the risk, in effect, that applies to an athlete to a spectator? Aren't they in different positions, and shouldn't the risks that are inherent in the sport may be different, opposing counsel argues, than the risks inherent in being a spectator? Why doesn't that make sense?
Well, the case law all across the country states the proposition that for this no duty rule to apply, it only relates to inherent risks, unavoidable risks, typically participating in a sporting activity. We see it with horseback riding.
Well, not really unavoidable, but inherent. I mean, you're going to get hit by a ball. I suppose there's a way you could avoid it, but if you're out in the outfield, one's going to come at you, that's inherent.
Right, and if you go to a Royals baseball game, you assume that risk. You know that there's no way a baseball player can control a foul ball or a broken bat. And that is the essence of this doctrine and what the cases have held all across the country.
And opposing counsel's argument, and I don't know if there's cases to address this, is that in today's sports environment, sports arenas, baseball stadiums, football stadiums are really entertainment venues, and people come not just for the baseball but for the spectacle. And and throwing of the hot dog is part of the spectacle, basically. And so when you come there, you recognize that there's a risk when things are always going to be getting thrown into the stands, whether T-shirts and so forth.
Well, and that's the issue that this court has to address.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of interest in this case all across the country. I've been contacted by numerous legal scholars that are writing about this case. They're writing all over Twitter for your opinion in this case. And you have to decide, is it good public policy to extend this doctrine beyond the activities of baseball players?
So help us weigh and balance the different policy matters
And I do think it's extremely bad public policy to create situations to sanction an environment where an employer, i.e. the Royals and their employees, potentially have the ability to throw things directly into the face of their business invitees with the potential immunity of the no-duty rule.
Isn't the crux of your argument that even though spectator activities or events occur, there is no inherent risk in them?
Well, exactly, and that's what the Court of Appeals found in Western District. It was Judge Wedding Company. He ruled in my favor in the Court of Appeals, and they held that the risk of being injured by a hot dog was neither inherent to a baseball game. Most courts all across the country limit the risk to those inherent to a baseball game. Nobody's gone to a mascot. But the Court of Appeals in the Western District held that risk of getting hit in the face with a hot dog certainly is not a risk of baseball, but it's not even a well-known incidental risk of the hot dog toss itself. This event has been occurring since 2000, was the testimony. And there is a history, apparently two people in the history of the hot dog toss have been injured. And that was my client and another gentleman by the name of David Allen. And that's because, and that's what the Royals want you to believe, is that, well, the risk of being injured by a hot dog is not inherent to a baseball game, but it's inherent to the hot dog toss itself. And that's a fallacy, because the risk only arises if the mascot is negligent. Slugger testified, the Royals management testified, that they're well aware that you should make eye contact with the recipient and toss it up in the air. If you do that, nobody gets hurt. But the evidence established this guy had a habit. He was 6'4", 250 pounds, a very strong 34-year-old man. He thought it was funny to just lean him at people. And that risk only arises if he's negligent.
But doesn't your point of there's only been two incidents, doesn't that lend it to the theory that it's unforeseeable? Its risk is not foreseeable given the now people getting hit by baseballs and getting hit by foul balls, that happens all the time. But the and foul balls going in the stands, but doesn't that get to the point of it being unforeseeable, extraordinary retrospectively? It's just not something that you could hold the team liable for.
Well, I mean, that's what the Court of Appeals held, is that Mr. Coomer did not assume the risk because it was not foreseeable that Slugger would throw these hot dogs at, you know, in a straight line forcefully at the guests.
Now, would your argument extend to, like, at the Cardinal games, they throw out T-shirts all wrapped up in a real tight ball in, like, a boomerang? Would your argument extend to that type of activity as well?
Well, it depends. If the person, let's say at Royal Stadium they had a K-crew, which are young women who throw out T-shirts, and if they've been instructed, if you're going to throw it out, you throw it at an arc. If that K-crew member is sitting on top of the dugout and wants to be funny and throws one behind her back and hits the guest, the business invitee in the face, then I don't think that's protected. And there is a difference between a T-shirt. These hot dogs were wrapped in foil. They were 4.5 ounces, and they were essentially projectiles. And so to me, there's a fundamental difference between a T-shirt, a koozie, and a hot dog.
Counsel, can you address our discussion here treats this issue of whether it's throwing a baseball is an inherent risk of being a spectator as a legal issue, and you're asking us to hold it's not an inherent risk of being a spectator. The instruction treated it as a factual issue for the jury to determine. It didn't say it was an inherent risk. It asked the jury, if I understand, instruction 11, to decide whether throwing the hot dog in the manner in which Slugger did was a risk inherent in attending the game, if plaintiff comprehended the actual risk, and if plaintiff intelligently accepted it. So it made it a fact question. Can you help us in figuring out if it's a legal or a fact question?
There are circumstances where this issue of whether or not were you injured by the negligence of the defendant or an inherent risk of the activity, there are circumstances where that could be a factual issue. But only if the underlying activity qualifies for that protection.
So if you're saying it's a legal issue whether it qualifies in a factual issue if that was the cause, because the instruction submits whether it's an inherent risk is a factual issue for the jury to determine in each case. So I presume the jury would determine, unless we held it as a matter of law, that that being hit by a baseball was an inherent risk or a baseball bat, that those are factual questions for the jury, although at some point maybe they become so well-known.
I think I've got your point, but in the Shepherd case, it's one of the seminal cases mm-hmm. cited in all the briefs, a young lady was injured while she was jumping in a long jump pit. She argued that the pit had been negligently prepared, and the school district argued that she was injured by a bad landing. And the underlying activity was a sporting activity, mm-hmm. and it was absolutely clear that the plaintiff assumed the risk of being injured or the inherent risks of a sporting activity. And it went, that was the one case I could find where the jury actually had to decide whether or not there was a duty or not, because they were asked to decide, under the underlying activity, was she injured by a negligently prepared pit or due to a bad landing?
Right.
Here, the underlying activity is not a sporting activity. He was not injured during play of a Royals game. Rather, he was injured by Slugger throwing hot dogs. And keep in mind, there's a case law, implied primary assumption of risk under the Ivy decision, which is the driver's license instructor that was injured by the test taker. Mm-hmm. That case stood for the proposition, if it's clear the defendant owed a duty to the plaintiff, implied primary assumption of duty has absolutely no application. You deal with a comparative fault. If the jury thinks that it's an accident, the jury can rule, well, I'm not going to find either party at fault. And here we're talking about an active negligence claim against Slugger. This is not a premises liability case where we were arguing that there's a dangerous condition of the property and they could argue where there's no duty because it's open and obvious. This is an active negligence claim based on the actions of an employee throwing something into the face of an employee, a guest. And under those circumstances, it's absolutely clear that Slugger and the Royals owed a duty not to injure their employees, an implied primary assumption of risk, no duty, doesn't apply at all.
Thank you, counsel. You have 3 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the board. I'm going to answer the two questions that were asked by everyone. First of all, to correct a couple things, there's no evidence anywhere in this record that Slugger thought it was funny to wing hot dogs into people's faces. That's not in the record anywhere. That he should make eye contact or not would obviously be a factor to be considered in secondary assumption of risk.
Do you have instructions to that effect? Was he instructed by a supervisor? Where would this eye contact...
He said he didn't say that he was instructed by a supervisor. He said that he thought it was a good idea to do that. But my point is that these things would be relevant to the negligence instruction or the secondary assumption of risk, and really not the issues we're talking about.
Can you explain that? If Slugger threw something negligently, shut his eyes and just threw it or something, could he still be liable under your point of view?
Absolutely, he could be liable.
So where does the primary assumption of the risk come in then?
The primary assumption of risk, even if it applied to the hot dog toss or to an attendance at the game, the implied primary assumption of risk only applies if the risk is inherent in a properly conducted activity. If he threw it in a negligent manner, the jury would find that the primary assumption of risk, implied primary assumption of risk instruction did not apply, would go to the negligence instruction, and then they would decide whether or not that, whether there was negligence and whether the negligence was a causal factor.
So in effect, all it protects the baseball team from, or Slugger from, is a jury finding just the very fact of throwing a hot dog is negligent. It says, no, that's just part of the game, but if you throw it wrong, or you can still be liable for that?
How it applies is that if the hot dog toss is thrown in a manner consistent with the risks inherent in that, if they're throwing them normally and someone is injured by a risk that's inherent, that is primary implied assumption of risk, and there is no duty in that situation. However, if Slugger would throw a hot dog in a manner that is negligent, like threw it right at someone that he knew was not looking, and the jury, and these are all jury questions, by the way, which decides this whole appeal, but if he threw it in a negligent manner, then under the negligence secondary assumption of risk jury instruction, the jury would have to decide whether or not the manner in which he threw the hot dog was A, inherent in the activity itself in which there's no duty, or whether it was negligent, and if it was a negligent throw, the jury would then have to decide, was that a causal factor in the injury?
So you're asking us to extend not only activities on the field, i.e. the foul ball, the broken bat, but also activities within the stands itself that are inherent to the game of baseball?
Let me take that on, because that's close. I'm not asking to extend the risks inherent in a baseball game to spectators. What I'm saying is a spectator in a Major League Baseball park is not just watching a ball game. And that's the question here. This issue about the risk being just confined to a game, the confusion that started is that because most of the cases in Missouri were baseball cases, and people in writing briefs started plucking quotes out of these cases and saying it has to be inherent in the game. Well, we don't have a person going to a game here. We've got someone who's attending a Major League Baseball game at a park where all sorts of this stuff happens at every stadium around the United States. If you look at the analysis of those cases, every single one of those cases refers to a sport or an activity. They don't limit it to baseball. If you look at Prosser and Heaton on torts, they talk about implied primary assumption of risk as freely entering into any relationship or situation. It doesn't say just a sport. And this Supreme Court, as far back as 1942, in a baseball case, Hudson versus Kansas City Baseball, they referred to primary implied assumption of risk. They referred to the proprietor as a place of public amusement. And that very case said what you look at are the conditions and circumstance of a given case. And you look at the character of the exhibitions and the amusement being offered. There's nothing that limits this to just the play of the field, and that's because people are inappropriately just plucking statements out of those cases.
Would you extend this to the situation where the vendor overserves another fan, and another fan is
that's
drunk and injures one of your other invitees?
That's different, because those types of things are statutory causes of action.
Dram shop.
So that's not dram shop. That's not what we're talking about here.
Do you have cases besides the one you just mentioned? Do you have cases where there has been found inherent primary assumption of the risk for sports stadiums and these events?
There's never been a case in Missouri decided that.
I'm not talking about
Missouri.
But we
do cite cases. There's a New York Mets case that we cited where there was actually the throwing of a T-shirt and someone was injured going for the T-shirt. It's a situation very, very similar to our case. And the case is very instructive. It's in our brief. It's cited, and it goes through an analysis. And it says, of course, in this day and age, the 21st century, you go to a Major League Baseball park, there's no way that you don't know that these types of activities are taking place. And let's put it in context, though, because what that case said was, as a matter of law, because it's so clear, we are going to find that if a spectator, just by going to the ballpark, is going to assume the inherent risks of that type of activity. If you didn't want to believe that, and I think this court should make that conclusion, but if this court was not going to make that conclusion, all that means is that whether primary implied assumption of risk applies is a jury question, and whether or not the risk was inherent in the activity, which puts you into this implied primary assumption of risk category, it's a jury question. And if the risk was outside of that because there was some negligence in the way the event was carried on, then you're in the secondary assumption risk.
But haven't we made it a legal question that an athlete assumes the risk of being hit by a ball when they're playing, or a spectator does? And so
absolutely,
those are really legally
not.
So how?
Absolutely not. And even Prosser.
You think a jury could find that by sitting in the stands, you don't assume the risk of being hit by a ball?
No. And Prosser and Keaton say this is not a duty question. This is a fact question. And Prosser and Keaton says every one of these situations is fact based unless it is so clear that by attending a game, you assume these risks that no rational jury could find that there was not assumption of risk. And that's why in the baseball context, it is so clear that the courts have said, as a matter of law, there's primary assumption of risk. And our position is that this court should find that same thing with respect to promotional activities that are so common. This has been happening for over 800 times before John Coomer went to the stadium, and he did not he sat down third baseline because that was a team he liked, but he also said in the almost 200 games he went to, he saw this event at every single one, and not only that, he knew it was going to take place on the third baseline He sat six rows behind where it was taking place, and he watched it himself for a full 60 seconds before he was hit.
Isn't there a distinction, though, between inherent risk and negligence?
There is, absolutely.
And that the fan, you know, reaching for the T-shirt may be an inherent risk, but
sure.
Slugger throwing the hot dog in a way that is negligent doesn't ever get you to the assumption of risk.
Absolutely does not. And so let's talk about the basics of this.
Well, first of all, if the jury had found that, they couldn't have returned this verdict, could they?
Yeah, absolutely.
So while that might be an interesting question, the instructions that were given here, if the jury followed them and believed that Slugger was negligent, then they wouldn't have ended up with the verdict they ended up with. Is that right?
I think I followed that. Yeah, they assigned Mr. Coomer 100% of the fault. They could have found that he threw the hot dog in a negligent manner, but also in analyzing the causation component of the negligence instruction, could have found that that negligence was not causal, because what happened here is, regardless of how you want to throw it, and obviously we have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant, but assuming he threw it in a negligent manner, what Mr. Coomer acknowledged is that he saw the motion of the throw. There were people in his area cheering for the hot dog, so he knew it was likely to come to his direction, and he looked away. And he didn't even say he knows it hit him, by the way. He may have been hit by a spectator behind him, but he looked away. So the jury could have found that he threw the hot dog negligently, but it was not a causal factor, because Mr. Coomer deserved 100% of the negligence, because his looking away was 100% cause.
Was negligence submitted as a separate cause?
I'm sorry?
What was submitted? Was it?
There were two instructions submitted.
Okay.
There was an implied primary assumption of risk, and that means that you assume the risks that are inherent in the activity. And if the jury finds, that's a jury question.
And what was the jury asked to find? Do you have that in front of you there in that instruction?
They were asked to find that he consented to the inherent risks involved in the activities of attending a game at Kauffman Stadium. And whether that, and then that was a primary implied assumption of risk. And then in the negligence instruction, they were asked whether, if the risk was not inherent in the activity, whether or not it was a negligently thrown hot dog and then a forced causation. So let me get back to the other question. The difference between the two instructions is that the primary implied assumption of risk involves only a situation where the risk at issue is inherent in the activity. And if the jury finds, or the court, if reasonable minds couldn't differ, finds that the risk is inherent in the activity, there is no duty as a matter of law, because it's an affirmative defense instruction. The only way you get to the negligence instruction is if the jury finds that there was some negligence, and say, take the hot dog toss, threw it so negligently that it was not inherent in the activity, then the jury gets to the negligence instruction. To back
you,
up.
You assume the risk, you're saying, of a properly thrown hot dog, but not of a negligently thrown hot dog.
That's a very basic way of saying it.
And you believe the instructions set that out?
They absolutely did. And with respect to the instruction issue, because in the briefs, the appellant was saying that the instructions were improper because they suffered the same defects as the Shepherd case had. We looked, and Judge Powell, I know, told me stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning to fix this problem. We fixed the problem with Shepherd. The difference between the two instructions in Shepherd, the verdict director used an ordinary care standard, all right? And that's dealing with the negligence instruction. That's a negligent standard. We, in our verdict director, used an ordinary care standard, talking about negligence. The difference is that in the implied primary assumption of risk instruction, if the plaintiff and appellant used a reasonably foreseeable standard. So it's negligence instruction and it's primary implied assumption of risk instruction. Both had negligence standards in it, which was either a roving commission. It was inappropriate. We fixed that because our implied primary assumption of risk instruction required what the cases say is that the risk had to be inherent in the activity. So we had a proper primary implied assumption of risk instruction where the risk had to be inherent in activity, and we had a proper negligence instruction, and the jury could not have found answered both instructions affirmatively, because one's a negligence standard, one is a primary implied assumption of risk standard, and the two are mutually exclusive. So we did not suffer the same problem that the Shepherd case did.
Can I ask a question, because I'm looking at the two instructions, and in, you're referring to 9 and 11, is that right?
That's correct.
In 9, it talks about the jury has the issue of negligence before it.
Correct.
And then it says, if you find that the defendant's employee was negligent in throwing the hot dog and there was damage, then you would assess a percentage of fault, except for 11.
Right.
And 11, when you go to there, you say the risk of suffering an injury by being struck by a hot dog thrown in a manner in which he threw the hot dog. So isn't that incorporating that it was thrown in a negligent manner?
No, and I'm looking at instruction 11.
You're assuming the fact issue, the jury, your assumption, or at least looking at the record, you're saying the jury could have found that he threw it with an arc and still got hurt.
Absolutely. In fact, the jury could have found that he wasn't even hit by a hot dog, because Mr. Coomer admitted that he doesn't even know if he was hit by the hot dog. But to answer the question, instruction 11, which is the implied primary assumption of risk, and I'm looking at the second paragraph you're looking at, if the jury concludes that the manner in which Slugger threw the hot dog was a risk inherent in the activity, that means that there was no duty as a matter of law. So if the jury answers instruction 11 in the affirmative, the case is over, because the affirmative defense applies.
But there's nothing there that tells them it needs to be a non-negligent way of throwing it.
Yes, there is. Was a risk inherent in the activity? And if it's and if it was conducted with only those inherent risks, there is no duty. The inherent in the activity and negligence are mutually exclusive concepts, and that's the key point. The bottom line here is that there's no rational basis to say that you assume the risk only of one activity at a time, such as a baseball game. Anyone knows when they go to the fairgrounds, for example, that there are a multitude of amusements. Do you assume the risk of going to a water slide but not the bumper car park? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And when you go to Kauffman Stadium, I venture to say I'm sure there are spouses that go out there because they want to see the fireworks more than the baseball game. There's an outfield experience there where there's a little cave where you can run around the bases, and there's a batting cage. There's a place where you can press a button and your favorite player, the light will go, and you can run against, I see my time's out. Is it reasonable to say that if a person chooses to do that and they're running on a level base path and the base is correct and they sprain their ankle, that they haven't assumed the risk of that because it's not a risk inherent in the baseball game? It doesn't make any sense, and all the case law and all the commentation says it doesn't make any sense.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, in the briefs, there are two cases cited that deal with the activities and mascots. The first one of which is cited by the Royals, it's Cohen versus the Sterling Mets. That's that New York case. It's a trial court decision, and in that case, a fan was injured by another fan who was chasing a T-shirt, and he happened to sue the baseball team.
And they found it to be a They found it to be a customary part of the experience of attending the sporting event.
Right, and that's being injured by another fan. And so, I mean, there's a difference. It didn't say, basically that case stood for the proposition that the plaintiff could not sue the team for injuries suffered by another fan. And that would be more analogous to our case if the plaintiff sued the fan that injured him, and that fan said, well, that's an inherent risk of baseball, fans chasing T-shirts. And so that case really is...
Why is fans chasing T-shirts inherent, but fans being hit by T-shirts not inherent?
Well, I don't think we should sanction a situation in society or this court that we should allow fans to act negligently and aggressively and strike other people and chasing balls with T-shirts in the stands. Again, I think the better public policy is to treat this under a negligence theory and a comparative fault, and the jury should be able to weigh the evidence, that if they think that neither party's at fault, then it, they can rule neither party was negligent.
Can you?
Now, the other case you were talking about was the California case.
Right, exactly. In that case, the court held the antics of a mascot are certainly not inherent in the game of baseball, and the team and the mascots have a duty not to increase or enhance the risks that a fan may otherwise have while attending a baseball game. But real quickly, the instruction, even if we want to go down this route that, okay, the no-duty rule potentially applies to Slugger, we're going to be the first court in the United States to hold that. The instruction was completely wrong. 9 and 11 misstated the defense on that. These two instructions, when combined, make the defense of implied primary assumption of risk an absolute defense.
Now, isn't, I mean, I looked at instruction 11, but wasn't there another instruction given to the jury that told them that they're not to assume any facts because there are words in the instruction that the facts are up for them to determine? Isn't there a model instruction that was also given with this one?
I don't know, but there probably is. But the problem with instruction 9, that's the same instruction that was rejected by the Shepherd Court. They put the tail on the verdict director. That required the jury to find for the defendant, even if that jury believed the defendant was negligent. The better way to handle this in this case, if you believe implied primary assumption risk applies, is to put the tail on the affirmative defense of assumption of risk, not on the plaintiff's verdict director. That way the jury could find for the Royals under assumption of risk, but only if they didn't find the defendant had acted negligently. This is absolutely clear that a plaintiff does not assume the risk of the defendant's negligence.
Was the instruction 9 and 11 given in this case, who tendered each of those instructions, or does the record reflect that both of those instructions were tinkered with by the trial judge?
I vehemently objected on numerous occasions to instruction 9 because of that tail instruction. I was well aware of Shepherd. I mean, Shepherd has the identical jury instruction. And Shepherd said that's a faulty jury instruction because it requires the jury to find for the defendant even if they believe the defendant was negligent.
And then what instruction did you tender in response to 9?
I objected. I tendered a verdict director battle tale. And that's in the record, and that's set up on my post-trial motions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
this matter will be taken under advisement. The court will be